Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Our guest for today is the great writer Isabel Allende. She describes herself as a novelist, feminist, and philanthropist. She's one of the most widely read authors in the world, having sold more than 75 million books. Chilean-born in Peru, Allende won worldwide acclaim in 1982 with the publication of her first novel, The House of the Spirits, which began as a letter to her dying grandfather. Since then, she's authored more than 25 best-selling and critically acclaimed books, including Daughter of Fortune, Island Beneath the Sea, Paula, The Japanese Lover, Long Petal of the Sea, The Soul of a Woman, and her latest novel, Violetta. Hope you join us for a conversation with Isabel Allende following the news.
This episode of Access Utah was originally broadcast in March of 2022.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Our guest for the hour today is the writer Isabel Allende. She describes herself as a novelist, a feminist, and a philanthropist. She's one of the most widely read authors in the world, having sold more than 75 million books. Chilean-born in Peru, Allende won worldwide acclaim in 1982 with the publication of her first novel, The House of the Spirits, which began as a letter to her dying grandfather. Since then, she's authored more than 25 best-selling and critically acclaimed books, including The Daughter of Fortune, Island Beneath the Sea, Paula, The Japanese Lover, Long Petal of the Sea, The Soul of a Woman, and her latest novel, Violetta. In 2014, President Barack Obama awarded Allende the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian honor. In 2018, she received the Medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters from the National Book Foundation. The Isabel Allende Foundation invests in the power of women and girls to secure reproductive rights, economic independence, and freedom from violence. And I reached Isabel Allende last week at her home in California. Here's the first part of my conversation with Isabel Allende. Well, your latest book begins and ends with a pandemic. You know, the Spanish flu up to the current pandemic was, I guess, very timely. Was that something you set out to do?
No. I start all my books on January 8th, and I started Violetta on January 8th, 2020, when the pandemic was not here yet. And I had already written like a chapter or two when the pandemic hit, and then I realized that my character is born in one pandemic. It would be only natural to end it during the COVID. Two bookends for 100 years of history.
Yeah, wonderful. I'm very interested to learn this. You begin your books on January 8th. Why do you do that?
Discipline and superstition.
Yeah.
It's a good day to start. I have started all my books on that day. And my first book was very lucky, and I thought, well, maybe the second one will be lucky if I started on the same day. And I did so. But in time, it became a matter of discipline because my life got really complicated. And now having a day to start allows me to clear my calendar, to be prepared. It's good.
Well, not that it matters, but that's my birthday. So that's a nice...
Happy birthday, then.
Now, every day on my birthday, I'll be thinking, well,
please,
Isabel Allende is starting her new book. That's a wonderful connection. So you mentioned House of the Spirits. Lucky, obviously, for you. It opened doors, I imagine. What did that do for you?
It changed my life. I had no life left to speak of. I was working, administering a school, living as an immigrant in Venezuela, as a political refugee in Venezuela. My marriage was collapsing. My children were going to university, so I felt very empty. And then I started writing this thing that didn't have a shape and ended up being my first novel. And by a stroke of luck, it became very successful in Europe from the very beginning, and that meant that I could eventually quit my day job and become a writer. So it changed everything for me.
You were in Venezuela at the time, were you?
Yes.
Yeah, and then eventually came to the United States. This was, you could call it exile, right? The political situation shifted suddenly, and... out of the country you were. I wonder what your thoughts are on, and now, you know, it's many years later, having lived in Venezuela and the United States.
Well, I think that Without the military coup in 1973 that really changed the direction my life was going, I would still be a journalist in Chile, probably a retired one and a happy one. But living in Venezuela all those years, I think I was sick with nostalgia, and I invented in my mind a country that was no longer there. Because when by the time I could return to Chile, and the dictatorship lasted 17 years, so that was a long time, everything had changed, and I had changed too. So the country that I remember is not there anymore.
Yeah. By the way, what did you think of the latest elections in Chile?
Well, I'm delighted. I think it's a scary time because everything is shifting really fast. The idea is to create a new constitution, and they are revising everything. Do we want what kind of country do we want? A federal country? What kind of country? Now, today, I think they are discussing the role of the armed forces. Do we want to have an army or not? So all this is really interesting, and the new president is young, very moderate. He represents the left of the country, and in Chile, the president lasts 4 years and cannot be reelected immediately. He can be reelected only once, but they have to skip 4 years. And that means that the country has gone like a pendulum from the right to the left, from the left to the right, and nothing gets done. So I don't know how much this young man will be able to do in the time that he has with all the changes that they are proposing, and he doesn't have a majority in Congress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wonder what... it's happenstance, right? The coup happened and off you went. What do you think that's done to you, being an immigrant and living in a foreign country, for example, writing in Spanish but speaking in English, for example?
Well, my first novel I wrote in Venezuela, three of my books in Venezuela, where we speak Spanish. And in a way, I think that the impulse to write came from being uprooted, trying to find roots in the stories that I had heard as a child, the stories I had left, the people I had left behind. It was an exercise in nostalgia, I would say. And in a way, also, being away from my country has given me a sort of perspective of the world. I have traveled extensively because of my books, and before, because I was the daughter of diplomats. So I have also experienced the role of a refugee and of an immigrant, which are different. And I think that gives me a lot of material for my writing.
Mm-hmm. Refugee and immigrant are different. Tell me about that. What you've experienced both.
Well, a refugee is someone who's running away for his or her life. Usually cannot choose where they go. They just need to get out. They are in despair. Usually, you know that most refugees are women and children, and they are received with hostility everywhere, and it's very, very hard. According to statistics, a refugee spends between 17 and 25 years away from the country of origin, and when they return, if they return, usually they can't bring with them their families because the children have grown up in another place and they don't feel any connection to the old country. Mm. And when they return, they don't have a place there either because everything has changed and they are older. An immigrant is a different situation because usually they are young and they go to another place with the idea of staying, planting roots, prosper. They have a vision for the future. They are not tied to the past. So the emotional situation of an immigrant is very different from that of a refugee.
Mm-hmm. Of course, the people who are being displaced, refugees, very poignant now with the situation in Ukraine, seeing those pictures once again of people fleeing.
Yeah.
Must be very poignant.
Every time there is war, there is occupation, violence, or poverty, extreme poverty, which is the case in most of Central America, people have to get out for their lives.
Mm-hmm. You've said that, first of all, you didn't believe that a coup could take root in Chile, and I did a surprise you lasted 17 years.
Yes, I don't think anybody except the military maybe thought that it could last so long, because Chile didn't have a tradition in military coups or caudillos, the chieftains that were a curse in the rest of Latin America. So we didn't know anything of how repression worked and how it would change the country. And the government of Pinochet established a neoliberal economic system that was extreme neoliberalism that was possible because the workforce was repressed. So there was ample freedom and opportunities for capital and for empresarios and for business, and also very cheap labor, because and there were no political parties or nobody representing the labor force. So that was, in a way, a very artificial way of implanting an economic system that eventually collapsed. But it changed the country completely. So now with this new constitution, the idea is to change the constitution that was imposed by the dictatorship. That constitution was amended several times during the democratic governments that followed the dictatorship. But basically, it remained the same, in which the state has very little input and everything is in private hands. Mm-hmm. So that created extreme wealth in a few people, a very small percentage of the population, a huge middle class living on credit, and poverty that is hidden.
So some extreme problems that need to be dealt with by the current government, as you said.
Yeah.
So after those 17 years, I guess it could have been that you could go back, but at extreme change, Chile is a different place.
Well, I could have gone back, but I was married to an American, and I was trying to sponsor my children to bring them here. So the idea of returning to Chile, I would have had to return alone, not with my children. They were brought up in Venezuela.
So you're in the United States. You obviously, I don't know. What are your thoughts still today about the role of the U.S. government in that coup and others in South America?
Well, the CIA was involved in destroying all the leftist movements in the whole of Latin America, and for example, in Central America, they supported brutal, corrupt governments. This was during the time of the Cold War, but in Central America, in 1980, there were genocides that were either ignored or supported by the United States government. So now, when people have collapsed governments that don't work at all, totally dysfunctional, and people run away and they come to ask for asylum at the border, well, this is a consequence of historical events.
I want to turn to talking about Violeta, the latest book. You have said that inspiration for the book came about with your mother's death two or three years ago. Is there anything of your mother in Violeta? Of course, Violeta's her own woman, but is there anything of your mother in that character?
Well, like Violeta, my mother was born in 1920 from an upper class in a country that looks very much like Chile, although the country is never mentioned, the name of the country. And she comes from a Catholic, authoritarian, male chauvinistic, conservative family. And she's brought to be a young lady who would be one day somebody's mother and wife. But Violeta escapes that role. And my mother did also. She married the wrong man, my father, and was able to annul that marriage and became a single woman with three kids. And then she remarried, but my father was a diplomat, and then she married another diplomat. But unlike Violeta, my mother was beautiful, smart, with a sense of irony, talented in many ways. She also had a sort of financial vision. You know, she could have made money if she had had any money of her own to invest. But nobody paid any attention to what she had to suggest. She was very powerless in a way. And that's a big difference between Violeta and my mother.
Mm-hmm. I've read that you have something like 24,000 letters, from your mother in boxes.
Well, they are not only from my mother. They are my mother's and copy of my letters.
Ah, yes. So
because yeah. I would keep copy of my letter, my daily letters to her, and then at the end of the year, she would give me back. So I kept her letters and my letters. And they are in boxes year by year. Very impressive.
Yeah, that's a treasure. That's really a treasure.
Well, I don't know if that's a treasure for anybody else except me.
Well, certainly for you, right?
Yeah.
Do you go back and reread any of those?
No, except when I have written memoirs. Then I go back to the boxes and see when and how things really happened. Because the letter records the emotion of the moment, not only the events, but how we felt about it.
Yeah. Oh, that is a wonderful thing. Do you carry that on to the next generation? We're in a different time now, right?
No, I think that my son will burn the whole thing. Why would he give that?
Well, I hope he keeps them. That'd be a treasure. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and my conversation with Isabel Allende, one of the most widely read authors in the world. She describes herself as a novelist, a feminist, and a philanthropist. Her latest book, a novel, is called Violeta, and we'll have more with Isabel Allende following this break.
This episode of Access Utah was originally broadcast in March of 2022.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Our guest today is the writer Isabel Allende. Her books include The House of the Spirits, Daughter of Fortune, Island Beneath the Sea, Paola, The Japanese Lover, A Long Petal of the Sea, The Soul of a Woman, and her latest is a novel. It's called Violeta. And here is the second part of my conversation. I reached Isabel Allende last week at her home in California. I want to talk about your feminism. You're known as a feminist a long time. You talked a little bit about your mother and how, how she was the system. You know, she was controlled. It left her, husband went back home, and now her father, I guess your grandfather, took over the finances. That sort of thing. As a teenager, is that when you became a feminist?
I think that I was born one. I was very young. I mean, 6 years old. When I was expelled from the German nuns where I was in kindergarten because I was already rebellious. So I did rebel against authority in general, male authority in particular, and I saw my mother very vulnerable. I wouldn't say a victim, because a victim is someone that cannot escape the situation, and she could have, but she was very vulnerable and powerless in every way, and I didn't want to be like her. So, of course, I didn't know the word feminism, but I was already very rebellious. And I must have been in my, 14 years old, 13, when I discovered that there was something called feminism. And by age 17, when I started reading feminist books from Europe and the United States, I realized I wasn't a lunatic, that there was a movement out there, millions of women thinking what I was thinking.
So you co-founded a feminist magazine, Paola, right?
I work there. Yes.
You found you could channel your anger into action. Wrote a series of satirical columns on the patriarchy called "Civilize Your Troglodyte."
That was one of the columns, but I did a lot of reporting.
Yeah.
Not only me. I mean, we were three women there. And we reported about all those things that had been kept hidden. I mean, and nobody talked about abortion, divorce, rape, incest, contraception, you name it. All those things that were talked about in gossiping or rumors, but nobody ever published anything about it.
Hmm. you've talked about how I saw an interview where you were talking about your work at the magazine, and you know did reporting, serious reporting, etc. But you said you found that humor could be a weapon.
It is a weapon,
yeah.
Tom.
Mm-hmm.
It
yes.
is. You know that. I mean, when you can make fun of something, that can really be. First of all, people listen because they don't feel any aggression in humor usually. And I would make fun of men, and they loved it.
They loved it. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, they would say, I have a friend who's just like that.
Yeah.
Always a friend.
They recognize at least the friend, right? Maybe if not themselves.
Yeah.
What do you think about feminism today, you know, sort of the Me Too movement and where we are today?
Well, there's a new wave of young women who are out in the streets pushing change. For a long time, I felt that feminism had somehow frozen in time. And now I see when women, especially now that women in the United States feel that their rights are threatened, the right for abortion, for example, now we will see a reaction to that, and they are reacting already. And this new energy was necessary. You know, the final goal of feminism is to replace the patriarchy. And that will take a long time, and we need a critical number of women engaged in this for that to happen. And I think that this new wave of young women can make that possible.
You think it is possible with the new wave?
Yes, not mm-hmm. right now. I won't see it. But it is going to happen.
Yeah, I was tickled to read in an interview I was reading. You said for years you wanted to write a romance novel.
I'm not good at it. I'm terrible.
so you were a kind of a regular romance novel that we would find. Why aren't you good at it?
Well. Yeah, the whole thing started because when we were working in this magazine in Chile, we had to compete with a magazine that came from Miami. And that the thing about that magazine was that it had in every issue a short story by a romance writer in Spain called Corinne Tellado. And it was more or less always the same story, very romantic. That you know, the typical green-eyed, big-breasted virgin that meets CEO in a tropical island, and you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I read a few of those, and I said, well, I can write this, and so that we can compete with this other magazine. And I tried. And I can't because I don't believe in the formula. I don't believe in the virgin with big breasts and green eyes. Never seen one.
Yeah, so you just couldn't get through
it
without laughing at the hero, I guess, right? Yeah. Well, that's probably to our benefit that you're not good at the regular romance novel, right? We love your books as they are. I want to talk about the Allende Foundation. I was reading, this is a spectacular story about how this came about. You were in India, I understand?
Yes, after my daughter died, I wrote a book called Paula, and the income that came from that book, I put it aside in another account because I didn't want to touch it. It didn't belong to me, it belonged to Paula. And I didn't know what to do with it until I went in a trip to India. And we had rented a car with a driver, and we were in Rajasthan in some rural area. And the engine got very hot, so the driver stopped. And a friend of mine who was traveling with us and I went to a group of women that were standing by us at a certain distance. And they were really very, very poor women and a bunch of little children, some of them naked. And we tried to communicate the way women communicate. We didn't have a common language, but we touched and we smiled, caressed the kids, and at one point we gave them a bunch of bracelets that we have bought in a market, and they were delighted with that. And so when we were leaving, one of the women gave me a little parcel of rags, and I thought she wanted to give me something in exchange for the bracelets. And I said, no, it's not necessary. I tried to give it back. And she wouldn't take it. And then I sort of opened the racks, and there was a newborn baby in there. I mean, I don't think it was a day old, really. The umbilical cord was still raw. And I kissed the baby, blessed the baby, tried to give it back. She wouldn't take it. And in that moment, the driver came running. And he picked up the baby, gave it to the first woman who was closer, and pushed me into the car. And when he had already started the car, when I reacted and I said, why would that woman want to give me a baby? And he said, it's a girl. Who wants a girl? And that sort of made me realize the fate of that baby and that mother that was willing to get rid of the baby because she couldn't even feed her. And I couldn't do anything about it at that point. So I decided that the income of Paula and my future books would go to a foundation to help mothers like that mother and little girls like that little girl.
Well, it's the Isabel Allende Foundation, if you want to help there. That's a great work you're doing. I want to talk a little bit about a TED Talk I watched. You talked about aging, and that there were some great benefits from aging. I wonder if you could tell me about that.
Look, I'm 80, and I married for the third time at 77. So let me tell you, Tom, you can really age in a very nice way.
You are, it seems like.
Well, look, I have enough resources for the basic needs, and that's really important.
Yeah.
And I have good health, and I have love, not only the love of my husband, but I live in a small community. Let's say I know all my neighbors by name. If I cook too much of something, I will give it to my neighbor who is 95 and she lives alone. So there is a sense of belonging that. And of purpose that is really important as you age.
Mm-hmm. You you divorced, I think, in your 70s and married in your 70s. I think some friends said, "Well, why are you divorcing in your 70s?" I don't know what they said about your remarriage. How's that been?
Well, when I divorced, everybody said, "Why would you do that after 28 years with this man?" Well, because it takes a lot of courage to stay in a relationship that is not working. And it takes way less courage to live alone. So we divorced, very very friendly and civilized divorce. And then I bought a very small house with one bedroom and moved in with my dog. And then eventually another husband landed on my lap.
Is this true? I read that he heard you on the radio.
Yeah. On NPR, actually.
He did. And how did it yeah. That takes a lot of courage to...
He heard me on the radio and started emailing my office morning and evening for 5 months.
Wow.
Every day. Until finally I went to New York for a Planned Parenthood event. And I thought, well, I should meet this guy. So I did. And we just liked each other very much. And he 3 days later, he proposed. He wanted to marry me. And I said, are you kidding? Why would I get married at this age? I'm not planning to have children. And but he insisted, and he eventually sold his house, gave away everything he owned, and moved to California. So we've been living together ever since.
Well, that's wonderful. Congratulations. That's wonderful.
Thank you.
I want to talk just briefly about writing. You, I love this quote. You say half the job is to show up. So I'm,
yes. That's why I have January 8th as a day to start, to show up.
Show up. So on January 8th, you show up, you start writing.
I show up no matter what.
And then I'm sure there's difficulties along the way. I guess you keep going.
Of course there are difficulties, especially at the beginning when I don't know where I'm going. And I just have to, again, show up. And, you know, I have learned that I have enough experience to write about almost anything if I'm given enough time to research and to just put the pieces together.
Mm. And you've said your characters, they appear to you. You follow them. What do you do?
When I start a book, if I am writing a historical novel, I have enough information, I have researched, so that I have like a platform or a stage where I will move the characters, but I don't know the story yet, and I don't know the characters. They will start appearing slowly as I need them. And some of the protagonists may just fade away, and some of the secondary characters may surprise me and become protagonists. That has happened many times. And what I have learned is to just relax and let it happen. Don't try to squeeze the story into a previous idea that I might have, a straitjacket in a way. If I let it flow, I make a lot of mistakes, and it takes a longer time because I don't have a script. But then the result is like a conversation, the way we talk, in the sense that I can connect with my reader in a more natural and organic way if I let the story just happen.
Do you, I don't know if you go back and encounter your books, or maybe through the experiences of your readers, and maybe you're surprised by things you didn't think were there when you were putting it together.
Of course, that happens all the time. Mm-hmm. The few times that I read a review, and I read very few, the reviewer usually finds in the text what I had no idea that was there. Because the writing is a very, organic process that happens more in the belly than in the mind. So when a story is analyzed and deconstructed and they find meaning in everything, I'm confused because I didn't know I had written something like that. I thought it was a much simpler thing. But what I have found out in all these years is that readers, men and women, but mostly young women, they find themselves in the stories. And they write to me and they say how I changed their lives, and they explain why. And I always say, I didn't do anything except put in words what was already in you. So you connected to the story because this is what you feel, what you think, who you are. Otherwise, there is no connection. So my job is just to write it down, but it's always inside them.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a wonderful connection to have, yeah. By the way, did you start a book this past January 8th?
Yes, I did.
Anything?
But because I am doing this book tour on Zoom and email and phone, I'm doing it for several countries and several languages. I have been very busy, but I started it, and by March I should be able to just concentrate on the new book.
Ah, very good. Anything you want to tell us or can tell us about that?
No,
new book?
I can't talk about something that is in progress.
Okay, I didn't think so. I just thought I'd try.
No.
Yeah, maybe. Very good. Finally, I was reading an interview. You said you're optimistic about the future. That the case? Optimistic?
Look, I have lived a long life, and I have seen the world get better, not worse. Right now, things seem pretty bleak. I remember the missile crisis. I remember the Cold War. I remember so many things that people forget. And we have now more information, more education, more technology, less poverty. We are better than we were when I was born. I was born in the middle of the Second World War, during the Holocaust and the atomic bombs, before the Declaration of Human Rights, before feminism.
Yeah, so reason for optimism. Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, we've reached the end of our time here. What a pleasure it's been speaking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you very much. Take care.
Take care. Bye now.
Bye.
Our thanks, of course, to Isabel Allende for that conversation. Recorded that last week. Her latest book is called Violeta. And, of course, she's author of many, many books. has sold more than 75 million books over the years, from House of the Spirits, Daughter of Fortune, Island Beneath the Sea, Paola, Japanese Lover, Long Petal of the Sea, The Soul of Woman, and as I mentioned, the latest book, Violetta. IsabelAllende.com is her website, IsabelAllende.com. And again, our thanks to Isabel Allende for that conversation. We'll take a break. When we come back, we will fill out part of the hour with going back to a conversation of 10 years or so ago, one of my favorite conversations with National Geographic explorer Helen Thayer. We'll have a part of that following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. National Geographic explorer and best-selling author Helen Thayer has truly lived a life of adventure. She was born in New Zealand and made at least part of her life in the United States. She once walked 4,000 miles across the Sahara from Morocco to the Nile River. She's kayaked to 2,200 miles of the Amazon River. She became the first woman to travel alone to any of the world's poles when she skied to the magnetic North Pole without a dog sled, snowmobile resupply, or support. We spoke some 10 years or so ago, and since then, at age 80, she became the first person to walk the entire length of Death Valley, north to south, alone. Here's just a portion of that conversation with Helen Thayer. Could you tell us a bit more about that solo trip to the magnetic North Pole? I'm reading from Lisa Schenker's article. She covered your talk to the children in Salt Lake City. I'll just quote from her story. Helen Thayer faced three polar bears on the first day of her expedition to the magnetic North Pole. Nine of her fingers numbed from frostbite. A fierce Arctic storm swept away all of her food, save a small bag of walnuts.
Well, it was a very tough journey, to say the least, because I was alone on foot, down on the ice with the polar bears, living basically on their terms, not mine. And no woman had made this journey before. No woman had even attempted to walk to this pole solo. And so I really had to call on my own outdoor experience. And it was very difficult because of the pressure ridges, the polar bears, the weather, the broken ice. But I knew that and I had trained for 2 years for it, especially for this journey. And so I was well prepared, and I had planned everything right down to the last detail. And so I felt so well prepared. I really knew that in spite of the difficulties, I could make it through, and I did. But there were some really scary moments along the way.
Tell us about one or two of those.
Well, the first, of course, was when I left, took that first step, when I left base camp, took that first step, I knew that I had not yet met a polar bear in the wild. Now, as part of my planning, I had lived with the Inuit people for some time, the masters of Arctic survival. They know all there is to know about polar bears and so forth. But in spite of learning, listening, training, I knew I really had to stand up to that first bear and see if I could do it. Well, the first day there were no bears, I saw lots of tracks. And then, now, I must explain, too, that I was the only human, but I did have my polar bear dog. I bought a fella I called Charlie from the Inuit. His job was to keep the polar bears out of the village and keep the humans safe. So a perfect companion for me. And I named him Charlie, and off we went. And, of course, he loved those tracks. He put his big black nose down in them and tried to follow them. Well, there's no way I was going to follow polar bear tracks. I would tell Charlie, I know what's on the other end. No way. And so, but it wasn't until the next day, I was taking my tent down around 7 in the morning to start the next day's journey, and suddenly Charlie, who was tethered to my sled, began to growl. And I looked up, and there was my first bear. And she had two cubs at her side. And she was growling. She was very angry that I was there at all. This was not the Arctic Welcoming Committee at all. And I stood there trying to remember everything that I'd been taught. Keep passive eye contact. Don't turn your back, they told me. Don't take a single step backwards. And don't run, because I'd never win the race. Well, I was able to stand and remember what I'd been taught, and it worked. And, of course, Charlie was, he went into his defensive mode to defend me and leaping high in the air, snarling and growling. And so the whole thing was working. Charlie was doing his job, as I knew he should, and I was doing mine, as I had been taught. And then about 30 minutes, the bear, she turned, took her two cubs away, disappeared into the rough ice. I never saw her again, but now I knew that, although I can't tell you how scared I was, I mean, my heart was beating so loudly and so fast, it about leaped out of my chest.
But in spite of that extreme fear, I was able to remember what I'd been taught. So now, of course, I knew I'd passed that final test, and I knew that I could do it. And I knew how scary it was. And I was very afraid through this journey many times because I met seven bears individually up close and personal, way too personal sometimes. But now I knew I could do it.
I was just going to surmise, and you've said it, you must have been frightened. You've been taught, you have Charlie, but still, is it going to work? I'm sure that's going through your mind.
Well, that's right. You don't know until the final test comes, and this is such extreme fear because I'm well aware that the last sound I could hear in my life would be the crunch of my own skull because that's how polar bears kill their victims. And polar bears do hunt and kill humans sometimes. So I knew of the danger. I wasn't out there just being totally oblivious and being some dummy. Oh, I think I'll walk to the pole today, and oh, well, the polar bears, they're nice cuddly pets, aren't they? I knew different than that. That's why I had to plan and train so completely. I couldn't leave anything to chance. But now, having passed that final test and described the fear, I don't think there's any way that I can truly ever describe that to anyone. There's no words to describe the full extent of it. And if I hadn't taken control of myself and basically walked through that door of fear to the other side, I could have panicked and lost control, and of course that would have done me in.
And a dog like Charlie is, you know, there's a huge difference in size. But a dog like Charlie really can be effective against a polar bear?
Oh, definitely. These dogs, they choose themselves, basically. The dogs are fed seal meat, frozen seal meat. And the polar bears, of course, this is their food, and they smell it from a great distance. They come in and try to take it away from the dogs sometimes. And there's a lot of trouble, a lot of fighting. Some dogs just don't survive. Others do survive. But Charlie, when he would race to a polar bear, he would approach head on until the last minute. He would whip his body around to the side and suddenly be at the back of the bear and grab its heel and hang on. And if you can just imagine a very powerful 100-pound animal determined to defend his owner there and hanging on to that Achilles tendon back there, you can imagine how that bear must feel.
What were some of the other barriers that you experienced in that trip?
Well, at one stage, I was engulfed in an enormous storm. The first time I was engulfed in a storm, winds, according to my wind meter, were around 70 miles an hour. And then the ice began to break up all around my tent. And, of course, my worry at that point was, would the ice break beneath my tent and drop Charlie and I and my tent into the ocean? And being alone, and in those days, remember this was in 1988, I didn't have a floatable sled or an immersion suit or any of the wonderful things that I could have now that simply didn't exist at that time. And so if I'd gone into the water, it would have been very difficult to survive. And I had to sit a day and a half in that tent, hoping that that ice would stay intact beneath my tent floor. And the ice was breaking up. I was actually in the midst of a major ice breakup. And you can be ground into little pieces just like the ice. But the ice underneath my tent held fast, and a day and a half later, the winds went down. I was able to step out of my tent, and all around me, the ice was just a mess, lots of open water. So then I had to take my ski pole, push the little pieces of ice together to make these bridges from one ice pan to another, and very carefully pull my sled across, and then carefully pull Charlie's sled across, make another bridge, push the ice together, pile more on top to make it strong enough, and then pull my sled again. And I did this for half a day because I knew if I could go about 5 miles north, then I would be on thicker ice, according to my charts and so forth.
That's a portion of a conversation from 10 years ago or so with National Geographic explorer Helen Thayer. You can find her at helenthayer.com. She's the author of several books, including Polar Dream, Three Among Wolves, Walking the Gobi, and Charlie, the Hero by My Side. On her website, she lists future goals. She'll continue to explore the remote corners of the world, create educational material for students kindergarten to grade 12 based on her adventures. She was referring there to classroom materials. You can find those at adventureclassroom.org. And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah today.
Time for liftoff. Let's go. It's one sky, many cultures. Skywatcher Leo T here. I awoke before sunrise about 5 a.m., went outside. The breeze commenced to coolly and happily blow with gusto, bringing with it some raindrops for a while. I decided to take a look up and around and get a little bit lost on a walk and in the sky. I was rewarded by finding an amazing triangle up about 45 degrees above the Wasatch front of the pre-dawn blue to the east. Bright, beautiful Jupiter holding down the home plate on the left, Mars at a 45-degree angle above, and completing the equilateral triangle is Aldebaran, the Eye of Zebul, in Taurus with its own glimmering double stars and trails. You can see this for the end of August still going on. A little earlier, I was also lucky enough to reel in the star-forming Seven Sisters or Pleiades above Taurus and the tail of Orion, the kite, below all of this with its intriguing nova. And speaking of novas, Corona Borealis T is ready to launch some nova action for the universe and Earthlings, and astrophysicists report that if we're lucky, we should be able to witness the cosmic workings of the universe. Also, if you get out in Capitol Reef, Moab, or the mountains, or lakes in the pines, or the thermal pools of Iceland, or the turbulent, dark Northern Ireland Sea off of County Galway in a fishing boat bouncing like a cork in the ocean, watch for the Perseid meteors arcing up this week to their peak. On this August Skywatching special, we look back and above us to find the star where the nova happens in the Corona Borealis, Northern Crown, or Council of the Chiefs, which is a beautiful, almost complete semicircle. It's between Vega, the brightest star overhead nights, and Arcturus, the other brightest star. It shows a golden glow and is found by arcing to it from the handle of the Big Dipper. Just above Arcturus is the Corona Borealis. It's a semicircle where we'll see the action. A star map, courtesy of Stardate Magazine, very good one, on the Skywatcher Leo T Facebook page. Thank you. It's a dark spot amongst the crown where an impending nova event so bright it's going to be visible on Earth with the naked eye. It's poised to occur. According to NASA Goddard T, Corona Borealis is a binary or a double system nestled in the Northern Crown. It's about 3,000 light years from Earth. The system is comprised of a white dwarf, which is an Earth-sized remnant of a dead star, but it's got a mass comparable to that of our sun, and an ancient red giant slowly being stripped of hydrogen by the relentless gravitational pull of its white dwarf, hungry neighbor. The hydrogen from the red giant attracts to the surface of the white dwarf, causing a buildup of pressure and heat. Eventually, it triggers a thermonuclear explosion big enough to blast away that accreted material. For Corona Borealis T, that event occurs every 80 years or so on average. It's one sky, many cultures, and there are so many creatures on the Earth that are also in the sky, and I bet there is one, but I'm not sure. But I know there is one in my neighborhood expressing feminine power and checking carefully and coming down out of the city cemetery and going into the block and finding something to eat, foraging and relaxing in the neighbor's backyard. In the heat of the day, foraging with her twin spotted fawns that she brings over after she scouted out the area. They also can be spotted up in the cemetery under the tall pines and will communicate quietly with me. Also with four legs is the horse. And paraphrasing from Animal Spirits Knowledge Card, Susan Boulay, in my own experience, the horse is a kind, intelligent being that I add puts up with humans. And in my own dreams, Leo T. here, one time I was running through a pine forest and saw a horse sprinting ahead of me, which I ran and mounted as she was running and rode into the forest. That dream is in my soul. In the Chinese zodiac, horse people are friendly, adventurous, and passionate. In Greek mythology, the winged horse Pegasus was the source of its inspiration and poetry. In the Hindu Ramayana, the king Dasaratha asked the gods to grant him a son and please the gods. To please the gods, he sets a magnificent horse free for a year. Then it returns as Vishnu. The Hindu word for avatara refers to Vishnu's ability to assume earthly form. So keep feeling, looking up, dreaming, and looking around the earth. Skywatcher Leo T.